You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today, we take a return trip into parapsychology and the parameters of paranormality with Morgan Knudsen. In her latest book, The Gift of Instinct, Morgan unravels the modern misperceptions of negativity and conflict that seem to have seeped into the cultural promotions of the modern paranormal. Morgan offers us ways to open our minds to reach our true paranormal potential and understand more about this subject. Morgan and I cover some pioneers in the field, the hold that grief can have from blocking paranormal encounters, and much more in a thought-provoking conversation. And as always, it is a delight and a pleasure spending some time speaking with Morgan. Before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, and bonus content. You can also click on the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com. News, episodes, and merchandise are all there. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Morgan now takes us on a journey of paranormal rediscovery and helps us to find the gift of instinct. On today's show, we return to the world of the paranormal and parapsychology in the company of Morgan Knudsen, author, educator, performer, investigator, and the co-host and co-creator of the marvellous Supernatural Circumstances with Mike Brown. Morgan has many strings to her bow, including in her new book, The Gift of Instinct, offering us collections of lessons to free our minds and realise our paranormal potential. Morgan, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Yes, it's always nice to speak to you. Hands across the ocean, as always.
Yes, absolutely.
How's Edmonton these days?
It is hot. It is hot. We are under a heat wave right now. So apologies to the audience if you can hear my fan going, but it is about 31 degrees and that's really warm.
Well, it's better than it was here last week. All you could hear was English people screaming.
It's true. Could hear it in Alberta. You guys are pretty noisy over there. I don't know.
Yeah, we all know that, unfortunately. Sometimes we are too noisy, I would suggest. So you've got this marvelous new book coming out, on top of the fact that you've started a regular podcast, which has quickly become one of my favourites, Morgan. So I know the last time we spoke, you were indicating about these new avenues that you were looking to investigate and build on the success and the knowledge that you've used in your first book. So was this kind of difficult? Because obviously the book's only recently come out and the podcast has been going for almost a year now, I believe.
Yep.
So as always, Morgan, trying to juggle two extremely challenging things. Which came first then, finishing the book, or was it a case of, well, you're doing the book in between writing and performing on the new show?
That's actually exactly how it went. It was kind of a mixture of both things, because the podcast, Supernatural Circumstances, came out at the end of October of last year. And then I was asked to write The Gift of Instinct, I think it was in November. And so it all sort of came together all in one big clump. So I was kind of going back and forth between the two of them, but they really played off each other really beautifully. So the knowledge that I was gaining in one would go into the other and vice versa. So it actually worked out really, really well.
Yeah. Well, obviously they are well aware of your workaholic tendencies, Morgan, and clearly thought that they should take advantage of those during lockdown.
I think so. I think that's a I feel used.
Go on.
But it was, yeah, it worked out really well. And especially too, in the winter here in Alberta, it gets really cold. And last year we had this weird weather where we would get warm above zero and then it would drop during the night. So the snow would melt during the day and then overnight it would freeze into an ice rink. Mm. So going outside, like driving anywhere, walking anywhere, it was so difficult. And our road services here are terrible. So it was really hard to get around just in general anyway. So the best thing I could do was just to sit in front of the computer and do this. Mm. So it actually provided a really great way to keep busy during a very strange winter last year.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. And even with your fire-breathing talents, Morgan, ice is a danger to most of us.
It's a danger. And here it was so strange because the roads almost looked like they were flooded, but it was solid ice.
Mm.
And because it was melting and freezing. So it was really, really scary. So a lot of the stuff that I was writing about, I could just sit there and, I was reading and doing a lot of that just around the house.
Yeah, just watching pedestrians slide past your window.
Pretty much. Yep.
The best way to watch the ice, I suspect. So with this book, as I said before we started the conversation, it's such an inspiring and positive outlook on the world of the paranormal. And I think it's one of those aspects that I've touched on with a few guests recently that I think we're kind of getting to the end of this. Anything to do with hauntings or the paranormal or parapsychology is either dismissed and poo-pooed or it's all terrifying. And I know when we've spoken previously, we're big proponents of the positive aspects of embracing the paranormal in all its facets. So was there a deliberate construction when you were pulling the book together in regards to how you wanted to get your thoughts and your feelings and your lessons, as the book is essentially a guide of how to deal with the paranormal and the way we handle it? Or was it something that you've always kind of felt strongly about, Morgan, and it was just about getting it down on paper to get it out there?
Well, it was funny because when they first asked me to write the book or write a book, I was struggling a bit because my first book, Teaching the Living, covered so much of everything that I wanted to talk about.
Hmm.
So I was struggling to figure out, okay, how do I, create a book that is so different that, is going to be as impactful and can still get people to walk away with exactly what you said, which is a positive outlook on this stuff. And I realized as I thought about it, that there is a running thread throughout all of the researchers that I've spoken to, myself included, everybody, parapsychologists, people that have gotten into this field and have really, really dedicated their lives to understanding this stuff. And that is this instinct and calling that is so strong and so powerful that people have literally thrown away extremely good jobs to pursue.
Mm.
And they've put their life, their old life on hold so that they can go and completely reroute themselves to understand what is consciousness, which is the big question of the paranormal. And I was one of those people, and I began to think about that and think about, what is that? What is creating that? And the more I understood it, the more I began to realize, it's not just in the world of the paranormal. It's in many people's lives. They have this instinct or this calling that's pulling them forward. And oftentimes the fundamental basis of it is, I know there's something more. I know I'm part of something more. I know I'm supposed to be doing something more. What is it and how do I get there? And it's not something that comes out of the logical mind. It's something that comes out of a very deep inner space, and not many people have the wherewithal or the belief that they can follow this and watch these doors open for them. But the ones who have watched exactly that, these doors start to open for them, and things begin to happen that they really can't explain. These things start lining up. There's some incredible things that have happened to individuals, myself included, that have gone down this path. And I think that's what I really wanted to talk about with this, which I didn't get a chance to talk about with Teaching the Living, And that is the idea that this is within everybody. And here's the people, here are the examples of people that have done this. These are pioneers that have, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants as researchers. And these are just, there's a calling within everybody, and everybody's got the ability to follow it.
Mm. Do you think this is something, because I've heard you speak about your life and how you ended up in the place that you are now, and I find a real affinity with that, Morgan, because, you know, I'm doing this show and I'm talking to you and I'm talking to all the other guests that I've ever spoken to, because I got to a point in my life where I'd hit rock bottom. And I say, sometimes jokingly looking back, that Poltergeist and Bigfoot saved my life, which they did. Mm-hmm. I know that throughout your earlier life, you had some challenges where life wasn't working. You felt trapped, constrained. You were sofa surfing. You were living hand to mouth, essentially. And I think, is this one of those things that when you've come to write this book, you've a real affinity with some of the people and the characters that you focus on in some of the chapters, because some of them haven't been perhaps as down on the luck as you or I were, or for a variety of reasons, both personal and through mental health. And I think some of the other people were in more learned professions. I mean, your great-grandfather is a prime example of someone that gave up a fabulous career to face ridicule, essentially. The same with some of the other people, such as Joseph Ryan.
Yeah.
That these were very learned people who were viewed as, I suppose people would say, that they'd gone crazy because they'd given up easy careers because they were very talented and very knowledgeable in the fields that they were entrenched in. But there was something about parapsychology and the paranormal that was their calling. And it took them, thankfully for our benefit, to a different place where who knows who we'd be talking about 100-odd years on.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting with a lot of these people, you know, everybody comes from a different place and it hits everybody at a different time. And some people, I think, you know, they go down a rough path, or they go down they have their struggles, like you and I have talked about before. And it's that trauma or that experience that creates that awakening for some people. But yet you have somebody like J.B. Ryan, who we were talking about a minute ago, where he had a lucrative career. He was professor in botany. He was at the top of his field. He had everything. He had the wife, he had the nice house, he had he had all of these things. And yet he goes to see this lecture from Arthur Conan Doyle about spirituality, and the light bulb goes off for him, you know, where he realizes, this is my calling. This is what I have to do. And enough so that he quit the whole thing. It even went back to school. He put himself right back to school as a student, to learn psychology so that he could prepare himself to pursue this. And I think awakening comes at different times for different people under different circumstances. So I'm not even sure if we can compare, you know, one story to another, because I think different circumstances have the potential of creating and causing that awakening. And whether or not somebody follows it is like an entirely different, that's a whole other ball game into itself.
Mm. Do you think it's easy for people like you and me, though, because we've got haunted bones, as they say, that because it's in our family's history and our family tree, and we've been exposed to it either through family history or even personal circumstances or just being around that kind of environment, that doesn't matter what we try and do in our earlier lives, there's something about this subject and these theories and these questions that really resonate with us, even if we try and hold them in or push them away for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I think, I think when you've grown up around it, or you've got a supportive environment about it, I mean, it definitely does make a big difference. And I think, if you're walking around with an academic reputation that's at risk, that definitely makes things really difficult. That's a really big decision to make. My great great grandfather, you know, when he made it, I mean, his colleagues tore him to pieces. Hmm. They were like, what are you doing? Like, you're a famous physician. What's wrong with you? Why would you you know, throw your life away to, you know, do this silly stuff. You know, and I'm sure JB Ryan like got the same attitude from a lot of people where they're like, what are you doing starting a parapsychology lab? Like, there is no future in this. What is your problem? You know, especially when they see it as something that is frivolous. But I think everybody, that really grasps the depths of what parapsychology is and what the paranormal means, I think they really truly understand that it is not something about, oh, you know, is this house haunted? Let's go, you know, run around a house and see if there's something scary that's going to happen. That this is such a deep and profound question of consciousness and our role as consciousness, as well as our role within it. And I think that's often what hits a lot of these people, even the academics who maybe have had no experience at all with any of it. I think it hits them in the same way where it's like, no, hold on a minute. This is about a big question. And those people, I think, are often thinking about that question prior. There's something within them that resonates with it, or else, you know, the words of someone like Arthur Conan Doyle wouldn't have resonated with him. He would have just walked away out of that lecture. But there was something there, something, an asking in him that was requiring an answer, and he received the answer. It just came through a unique venue.
It is. And it's fascinating, really, like you say, because often people gravitate towards the paranormal more often than not in this day and age through personal experiences or a deep interest in it. And often when we look back at that period of the late 19th and early 20th century, as you were pointing out there, the vast majority of things that had happened up until that point were extremely frivolous. Sideshow performers, con men, fraudsters, sleight of hand. And yet, even academics and scientists thought, well, actually, I think there's more to this than meets the eye, and sort of reclaimed it at that period to bring it back into the academic fold when you have the Society for Psychical Research being formed and the way that they began to grow. And then obviously, as the 20th century dawned upon us, more people became aware of it, and radio and newspapers and books started appearing and being written by intelligent, articulate, well-educated people, which kind of elevated the subject again. And I think often when we look around about what's happening in the modern era over the last 20 or 30 years, we seem to be going through this frivolous period, and all the serious scientific investigation and boundary pushing, it seems to be bubbling under the surface again. And I'm just being too positive or too hopeful, Morgan, I don't know, but I've got a real feeling that there's a momentum coming from the bottom now in the paranormal and parapsychology, that it seems that once again the learned people are beginning to drive the car.
Yeah, I believe that too. And I think now it's a matter of getting the information out to people who want to hear it. And I think that's the majority of people. You know, I do a lot of live classes. I do a lot of live shows and things like that. And every single one of my audience members that I speak with, every one of them is at that point. Like, a lot of them have, you know, they still watch the, you know, the silly ghost shows on TV, and they still have fun with the entertainment side of it. Hmm. But there's another part of them that is feeling that same inkling, which is, why is this happening? What is this? What does this have to do with me? And I think that their inkling is right, that it, you know, it does have something to do with them. It's everything to do with us. And I think that is beginning to bubble to the surface, especially the more we advance in things like quantum physics. Mm. With quantum physics, understanding consciousness can't be done without parapsychology, and vice versa. We have to have both pieces. And so I think now, you know, a lot of these, what were once theories and, you know, nice ideas and, you know, maybe considered fantasy, is now being confirmed or theorized now by people who are making pretty good names for themselves in the scientific community. Everybody's having to take another hard look at it, because it's not just conjecture anymore. Now it's going, okay, wait a minute. This actually is explaining what people are experiencing, you know, when they're having things like a near-death experience, or they're having things like, you know, the movement of objects, or seeing apparitions, or and things like that. So I think now, you know, it is becoming unavoidable. We have to take a hard look at this.
Yeah. And I think one of the frustrating aspects for me is that, especially when it comes to paranormal research and parapsychology, there are certain things that seem to get thrown out for decades. And then they start to sort of return again. And I've often been really surprised because when we talk about things like remote viewing, primarily, these were experiments and programs that were heavily invested in that we know of by the US government, and therefore one can presume that every other major superpower in the world at that period was probably doing the same thing as well, Morgan.
Absolutely.
Whether that information will ever see the light of day, but I would be more shocked to discover that perhaps Russia, China, Britain, France, even Canada, even their military forces were not investing in some kind of experiment or program on a similar level to what the US were doing. And yet now when you talk to some people, they almost view remote viewing as some kind of urban legend, despite the fact that the papers are there, the records are there, we know it happened, we know who was involved, and we also know, incredibly, some of the amazing successes. Yes, a lot of it was gobbledygook and nonsense. However, that does not negate that sometimes some of these remote viewing experiments and programs were terrifyingly on the money.
You bet they were. And they were used in some very high level operations as well. There was a presentation a couple of years ago about how they used remote viewing to help find Saddam Hussein. There was, and how it was used within the Gulf War to locate bombs and things like that around the oil rigs. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff, I firmly believe that there's stuff that is still going on, and they may have even surpassed where they were at that point, which is, you know, might be part of what we're seeing, that, you know, people are going, you know, poo-pooing some of this. So it might actually be, who knows where they're at with it now. But, you know, you look at these institutes that are, you know, hardcore working this information and this knowledge, like the Monroe Institute. And I mean, the level in which they are able to get to and to teach other people to do it is absolutely mind-blowing. And I agree. I think that when it comes to whether it be, you know, Canada's military or overseas or whatever, I have a hard time believing that they dropped it. I can imagine them, as I say, surpassing it. And, you know, and that's why maybe why they felt that they could, you know, release some of the Gateway Project documents and things like that that were floating around. But I struggle with the idea that they just dumped it.
Well, I think if we've learned anything about everything that's been going on with UFOs over the last 5 years, is not to believe anything any government tells us about these secret programs, because they clearly carry on with it.
Well, and oftentimes if they're showing indifference to it or something like that, you could almost guarantee that there's something actually going on. So, the indifference is actually usually a pretty good indicator to go, okay, well, wait a minute. They probably care then.
Very, very true. Very true. Maybe I'm just, when it comes to subjects like this, I'm just deeply cynical of any official lines, because I know there's enough evidence to just say, well, you said that before and you were lying.
Oh, it's true. And you know, I think too that, you know, over the last number of years, the public is just so over any sort of headlines and misinformation and things like that, that I mean, it's the lack of trust that has cropped up, I think, is even worse. Like, I even remember a couple of years back when they did release some of the UFO stuff, and the world basically ignored it. You know, it came out and it hit the news and everybody was like, you know, like, ever, the trust has just been so eroded at this point. I mean, it's really, really hard to tell what's going on. I think the only thing that people can do is start to experience and research this stuff for themselves. Like, you know, going to programs like at the Monroe Institute that you could actually go and take. You could take the classes, go through the process, and draw your own conclusions about it.
Mm. I mean, as you mentioned there, Monroe was someone, I'd heard his name, but I wasn't very aware of who he was and how he got there and what he ended up creating. He seems to be one of these people that we often get in the sort of latter part of the 20th century, Morgan, that he's one of these people that seems to have dropped off the map, primarily, I think, because most of his work and his success was done before the mid-90s. And therefore, as anybody that knows anything about paranormal television, missed the boat by about 3 years before cable television brought the paranormal into everybody's homes with the successes of programs like Sightings and Unsolved Mysteries and other such shows. And obviously the X-Files driving it along as well. So he seems to be one of these people that once you discover who he is and you read about the work that he was involved in and how he decided to get involved in, as we were saying about Ryan earlier, here we have an extremely talented man in the field of entertainment and aviation who has a life-changing experience brought on through meditation.
Yeah, and I feature him in my second chapter about the lessons of letting go, because he is such a profound example of that. And he was also a great example of what we just talked about, which was this sort of wayward kid who really didn't have, everybody thought the kid didn't have much going for him. He couldn't keep a job. He was bouncing all over the country. He was hitching rides on trains. I mean, he was just all over the place. And, you know, he was every parent's worst nightmare. You know, he's failing grades and he drops out and everybody's looking at him like, you know, what the hell is this kid going to do with himself? And, you know, yet here he is, you know, probably one of the brightest minds that the parapsychology world has ever seen. And he becomes an audio engineer and, you know, has this experience and begins to understand the concept of audio frequency and the mind and the brain and how it works and how they affect each other. And it's such a phenomenal story. And I think it gets even more phenomenal, you know, once he starts to have these interpersonal problems with his daughter, and his wife passes away, and all of these different things that start to happen, and the lessons within his own story, I think, really speak to the idea of what we're talking about, like things like remote viewing and the idea that a lot of this stuff is about letting go and allowing these things to come rather than trying to force this stuff. So I don't know. I don't think he necessarily, I think he definitely missed the boat in terms of entertainment and popularity. But at the same time, I think he hit it at a really good time, in the sense that he was able to develop what he needed to develop without the public on top of it, in terms of, you know, trying to make it into a television show or trying to exploit it somehow. You know, I think he came at a good time for that, because I don't know if the lessons would have been the same had he made it a little bit later.
I'm always deeply, deeply fascinated when I hear reports or people talking about their experiences when it comes to out-of-body experiences, especially when it comes to Monroe, because he's one of those people that when you hear about this subject, a lot of people go, oh, well, it's, you know, it's your brain just creating some kind of false narrative. It's like, as I'm sure we'll touch on later on, it's very similar for me in regards to near-death experiences as well, that there's an explanation for all of this kind of thing. And yet when you look at Monroe was one of those people who seems to have trained himself to such a level in this particular field that I know you mentioned that he'd lost a couple of friends.
He did.
And obviously for most people, that would be a time of grief and reflection and probably a bit of guilt and things about unresolved issues or conversations you can never have or things like that. Monroe just thinks, well, what I'll do is I'll just drop into my meditative state and I'll go and have a chat with them on the other side.
Yeah. And it's so powerful, because I think not only did he teach us about the concept of letting go, but also of surrender to what is. And that was such a great example of it, is that, you know, there was no pushing against, there was no resistance. And because of that, he goes into these meditative experiences, and he saw one and had a conversation with the other. And, you know, he made that connection really, really easily. And I think to the outsiders, you know, people might have said, well, you know, he didn't care, he wasn't grieving in the same way or anything like that, but he really understood the letting go and the surrender to what is, and acceptance, and he accepted it and then was able to contact them from a far clearer place that wasn't bogged down with the ego and grief and things like that. So yeah, really, really profound example of, you know, some of these key lessons that are in life and in parapsychology as well.
Mm-hmm. And yet, even for all his success and the knowledge he had in this field, once his wife had passed, I found this portion of that particular chapter rather sad, that obviously he'd lost his lifelong partner, the love of his life, and so he wanted to go and find her. And because he wasn't able to connect with her for whatever reason, even that may be down to some kind of internal barrier that he'd created without actually realizing it, Morgan, or it doesn't work every time, even for somebody as experienced and as knowledgeable in this particular practice as he was. He viewed it as a complete failure to the point that he said, that's it, I'm never doing this again.
Yeah. And oftentimes, even with my own career, I've had a lot of people talk to me about similar experiences. And actually, in one of my last classes a couple of months ago, I had a young girl in the audience, and she came up to me later and she said, you know, my father passed away and everybody around me that knew him is having experiences except for me. And I keep trying and trying and trying, and I don't know what's going on. And one of the things I told her was the fact that part of the reason is because you're trying. And it sort of works as a, you know, what you resist persists kind of thing, where the more you try, the more you're aware of them not there. And because you're aware of their absence, you attract more absence. So one of the things that I told her to do was I said, you know, set the intention, you know, get quiet with yourself, set the intention, and then let it go. And, you know, just let this, trust the fact that this is going to happen, but let it go. Get yourself into a better feeling place. Doing something else, doing something that's going to take the resistance out of this. And it was about 3 weeks ago, I got a message from her and she said, holy, you were totally right. It happened. I had an experience with him and I couldn't believe it. But she said, I had to let you know that this is what went on. So, you know, the closer we are to things, especially when it comes to like the loss of a loved one or something like that, unfortunately, at the beginning anyway, the less likely we are to have that experience, because we're so aware of their absence that it just perpetuates the observation of absence.
And I think it's one of those things that often we're constrained by the parameters of society, that as silly as it may sound, people will view that as some kind of confirmation of their relationship with that particular person. They'll think, well, they obviously didn't really like me that much. I can't have been their favorite. They don't love me anymore.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is as hard for people to deal with when other people are experiencing things. It's one of those aspects that I think we've all lost people that we dearly love in our lives, from family to friends to people we work with. And I think sometimes the grief that we go through can frame how we view anything else that's happening. And I'm not saying people may get jealous, but often we view it negatively if we're not the one that's having an experience. Whereas I think if we can open up and look at it in a more positive way, we should be happy that someone is experiencing something. And it may not be us, but clearly if someone else is having an experience that is often giving them comfort or lessening their grief or allowing them to move on in whatever way, then I think that's something that often, rather than celebrating it, a green-eyed monster appears, Morgan, and we feel a bit envious of it. And often that, again, just constantly magnifies the emotional stress that that person may be feeling, which in essence would probably cause a barrier for them to open up and allow it in.
Absolutely. And oftentimes it's our ego. Our ego tells us a story about what it is we think is happening, you know. Well, like you just said, or, you know, they didn't love me enough, or, you know, I did something wrong, or something, you know, there's some glitch in the matrix that it's not happening, you know. And often, and then of course that compounds the fact that, okay, it's not happening because now you're even more aware of what's not happening, and you're telling yourself a story about it. So it really starts to compound itself. And really the best thing that people can do is to let go and prepare for those messages and those connections to come in a variety of different ways. When my business partner and best friend, when she passed away a number of years ago, it was really funny because I had too much resistance around her passing to get any messages from her, but her colleague at work, she didn't. And what would end up happening, and it's so funny, and it still happens to this day, is that I would have a question, or I'd be, you know, be wrestling with something or whichever. And her coworker, who I would only hear from, I don't know, it was very rare, because I mean, the two of us weren't near as good friends as Steph and I were. Mm-hmm. But I would all of a sudden get a random phone call and she would say, "You're never going to believe what happened." And she would tell me something like, you know, all of a sudden my stereo went crazy and started tuning to a song that I've never played or never heard. Or at one point she had an old iPod that never worked. And all of a sudden that would turn on and start blaring and it would go to a song that was never played. And when I would look up the lyrics of the song, it was the answer to the question that I had been asking before. And she had no idea that I was asking those questions. She had no clue. But it was within 24 hours, I would get that phone call from her. And she would say, "You know what? I don't know what this means. I knew I was supposed to call you with this. Here it is." And it was always that same thing. So sometimes it'll come through the path of least resistance that you just can't really anticipate. You really do have to let go and let the, you know, let source energy do the work instead.
Yeah. And it's one of those things as well. I think grief is a very similar thing that I've had conversations with people about other people who are grieving. I'm often struck rather negatively sometimes that sometimes people believe that their experience of grief is how everybody else should deal with things. Or they say really silly things like, "Well, it's been 3 months. You think they'd be over it by now." And things like that have always deeply struck me on a personal level, Morgan, because how I feel about something is never going to be the same as you or someone else feels. How the passing of someone is never going to affect me in the same way it would affect somebody else. So I'm often mystified as to why, once again, we seem to have this rule book of how people view things. Of how we're supposed to grieve, how long we're supposed to grieve, why we're supposed to grieve, what we do if we don't get a sign from the other side, as if we've got this predetermined scorecard that makes us lesser people, or we seem to be a failure on some level because of how we feel about things.
Yeah, and I think in this particular area, it can get really, really glaring because even in the area of how the messages show up, you know, people often think, "Well, you know, I haven't had this glowing apparition appear in my living room. So therefore, you know, nothing's happening," when, you know, there's all these other things that are going on around them. But because they've got this filter that this is how it's supposed to look, then they miss all these other bits and pieces. And, you know, what I'm always telling people and telling clients and the audience members and things like that is that oftentimes this comes right back to the idea that it is our own personal awakening. It's our own personal ability to go within, to find that space, that inner space between, you know, who we are and our thinking, and that stillness. Because at the end of the day, you know, we can't control what other people are saying. We can't control what they're thinking about us. And in the end, it's none of our business anyway. But the only thing that we can do is to find our own space within it and allow this stuff to manifest and come through. Because as soon as we're starting to look at what other people have in their mind and their presets about how this is supposed to go, then you end up manifesting stuff you don't want to manifest. So when you've got something where you have people that are, you know, coming down on you and turn around and saying, you know, "No, it's supposed to look like this. It's supposed to look like that." The funny thing is they're actually creating that reality for themselves. Mm. You know, there was a study done a number of years ago where they were looking at the idea that skeptics are actually manifesting their own results. Because they're skeptics, they've now proven the fact that they're skeptics, because that's what they're manifesting. They're manifesting no results. So it's one of those things where, I mean, we only have control over our own reality.
Yeah. And I think often when I talk about these subjects, I will always say that I am skeptical. I think you have to be, because especially, I could spend all night going through things that aren't real or put forward as real experiences and real hauntings and real results. And it's a load of old hogwash. The world of the paranormal, as with many aspects of investigation, is littered with fake results and personal bias creeping in. And I think you always have to take a step back when you're dealing with these kind of subjects. Because at the end of the day, as you say in the book, and I've said this to a lot of people, parapsychology is for me a deeply important pursuit, because it's answering one of the most important questions, which is, where do we go? And I think too often it gets trivialized as looking for ghosts running around old houses at night in the dark. Whereas for me, it completely misses the big picture here, and that is we are essentially energy batteries. We are walking, talking energy. And as anybody with a passing knowledge of how energy works should know by now, energy cannot be destroyed. It simply becomes something else. And regardless of whatever facet of the paranormal or parapsychology that you find deeply interesting, the one result that keeps it all tethered at the base is what happens next.
Yeah, and that disidentification with form. And I think that's sometimes where people get hung up, and where we see in the world of the ghost hunting and things like that. I mean, I've done interviews by, you know, ghost hunting teams and things like that. And you bring up the idea of, well, what is consciousness? And they're like, well, we never thought about that. Mm. You know, they're thinking on this very like one-dimensional level, that it's like, no, we're looking for a ghost though. Like that's what we're doing. And they've missed that bigger picture, which is where I think some of the bias comes from, where people are like, well, you know, this is silly. Well, when you look at it like that, yeah, it kind of is. Like, this is about a bigger question. And that's such a minute part of, you know, what we're actually looking at and the questions that we're asking, or what we're really looking at when it comes to parapsychology, which I think people, if they broached it this way, would begin to understand, is that we're looking at what is beyond form, and that the intelligence and the presence that is us behind the ego and the us behind the physicality and the materialism. And once you begin to look at it like that, I think the question becomes a lot more serious. And that's when all of this other stuff starts to look a little bit more, a little bit more frivolous, and that's okay. You know, it can be that way. Cause I mean, you know, the other stuff, I mean, it's fun and everything, but, you know, when it comes to the actual skeptic side of it is, you know, that's the question that if they're not asking that question, then, you know, there's something limited and some issue with their own thinking.
And I think often as well, you can get bogged down and follow templates from how you expect to be able to do these kind of things, or do this kind of research, or investigate locations in a specific manner. There seems to be, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do this, you've got to have, if it's a haunted house with an alleged child in there, you've got to take toys with you for some reason, or you've got to take a radio that tunes into really bad static and can't possibly be picking up anything else, which I always find deeply concerning. having once been terrified by a taxi coming through my music speakers.
Oh, geez.
Which is one of those things that until it, you know, and it happened about 10 past one in the morning with the lights down low, and you just hear this, hello, hello. You're like, what? What's coming through? And then he's like, I'm just going into the city centre. I've got a fare. And you're like, oh, right. Okay. It's a taxi. Yeah. Or is it? Is it a ghostly taxi? Who knew? But when you, at first, anything like that strikes you as, oh my God, what's going on here? And I think often a lot of people say, right, well, if you do this and you do that, you're fine. And there are so many things that often seem to be used in the modern age that there is this, for me, there are two camps in the modern ghost hunting field. There are people who use the traditional kit, which is your Ouija boards and your calling out and using trigger objects and things. And then there are the other people that are just using masses and masses of specific technology. And you may call me cynical, Morgan, I'm not sure, but I'm often very dubious about particular equipment that has been designed for the prime result of proving something is haunted, be it these, you know, that these really strange cameras that pick up dancing stick men everywhere. There are so many things that if it's designed for a specific purpose, the cynic in me says it'll create the specific result.
That, yeah, and I couldn't agree more with that. And that's, and oftentimes too, I notice a great misunderstanding about how some of the equipment actually works. One of the ones that I've noticed the most over the last little while is people using a very similar technology to what the video games are using, and sometimes they're actually using video game systems to pick up on, you know, people walking around a room or invisible entities walking around a room, and you know, they see kind of a grid or something like that on the wall, and then if you know the camera picks up the movement, then it finds it connects the dots and finds, you know, if there's a person in the room and things like that. And it's things like these misunderstandings that are a problem, because these systems are designed to find patterns in nothing.
Yes.
They're designed that way. So, you know, if it finds a random pattern somewhere, it's going to connect the dots and it's going to say, hey, there's a person there, when there isn't. So there's a lot of that I've noticed where, you know, people thinking that they're getting results where in fact the system is designed in a way that you should be getting something, because that's how the AR picks up whether or not there's a person sitting there so that you can interact with the video game. So it's stuff like that that I've noticed is just sort of a misunderstanding or misuse of equipment. But I think the number one tool that people have forgotten when it comes to spirits and connection to something bigger, is that they've either not put the work in or have a little, very little understanding of the fact that unless you can sit and become present in the now and connected with that, which is the greater part of you, that what you're going to end up getting back is very anecdotal, and it's never going to be enough. The true experience of connecting with spirit and connecting with loved ones and source energy and all of that comes from the ability to stop thoughts, stop the mind, or not let the mind overtake you, and connect with that deeper part of ourselves. And the answer is not out there. And and chasing all of those things, it's fun, but it's not ultimately going to be the satisfactory experience I think that people are looking for. They're looking for that one bit of proof. Well, there isn't one bit of proof. The proof that you're looking for is going internally and discovering that presence, because that presence is the consciousness that is connected with the loved ones and the spirit and all that kind of a thing.
Absolutely. And once again, you fall into this rule book that doesn't exist. This proves that somebody's doing this. I mean, I've got a very strange thing going on in my flat at the moment where cutlery is disappearing, Morgan. I don't know why. and it's quite noticeable because it's specific items of cutlery that are in a set. And it's gone. We don't know where it's gone. We've no idea where it's gone. It's just vanished. And we've had a few things. And this, strangely, is also, we've had a few weird things happen over the last sort of 12 months since we discovered that the property I now live in was blown up during the Second World War. The house next door took a direct hit.
Wow.
And was obliterated. And unfortunately, the house next door, there were 7 people in it. They were all killed. They took a direct hit by a bomb. And within 3 weeks of us finding this out and doing some research, because there's lots of documentaries and books about the Sheffield Blitz. There was nearly 700 people killed in 2 nights of bombing during the Second World War. Once we'd pulled back that curtain, it seemed that something decided to say, well, I'm glad you're interested. Here I am. Because since then, we've occasionally walked around the property and we will smell cigarette smoke extremely distinctly. Neither of us smoke. There's nowhere for the smoke to come from. And it lasts 2 or 3 seconds and it dissipates completely, gone. And we just thought, well, this is a bit odd. And then it seems to have ramped up that we've obviously stopped paying attention to this weird smoke now. And now it's started to nick our cutlery.
Isn't that funny? It's so interesting how some of this stuff comes about. I mean, I've had similar stuff happen around my place as well, where either things have gone missing and then reappear somewhere where I've blatantly looked before. Or, you know, we've had some pretty extreme stuff happen here. There's a bird bath on the balcony, which the birds here use all the time. And the bird bath at one point imploded on itself.
Oof.
And it was, and it's glass, and it literally went everywhere. It was crazy. There was no reason for it, nothing. There's been a number of things happen around the house that has been really strange. And my little python, interestingly enough, has seen somebody that he seems to know around the house as well, and greets him. He has a very specific greeting for people that he really likes and that he recognizes. And about every, I would say about every 4 months or so, somebody shows up and he gets very excited and he goes and he greets midair. And he has an interaction with them that lasts probably around 20 minutes. And then they seem to disappear and he looks around like they're gone. And he just moves on and does his own thing. But like there's something here that visits. And it comes and does all sorts of little things around the house it would oftentimes either remove my pictures from the wall and then place them leaning up against the wall. Or it used to do that. A nail, everything was fine. Like nothing had been ripped out of the wall or anything like that, but it would take pictures down and prop them up and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, it comes around every once in a while. So it's really cool. I mean, this stuff is as magic as you want to get it.
Absolutely. And once again, these aren't traditional hauntings. These are not the kind of things. I mean, you know, that sounds a bit, mine certainly sounds like a bit poor showing, really. You know, it's just a bit smelly occasionally. And now it's taken a shine to cutlery, which is more frustrating than anything else. Fritz, it's interesting because it's so noticeable that when you smell these aromas, you're like, oh, it's literally like you've walked into a cloud of cigarettes. It's like somebody's just had a cigarette. And you're like, oh, that's odd. So is that proof of something? I don't know. It's peculiar. It's weird. As the natural skeptic in me, I check everything. I smell other items around. And like I say, neither of us smoke. Nobody comes to the house, but nobody smokes in the house. There's nowhere for people to put smoke in. It happens in different rooms at different times. There is no rhyme or reason to it. If it was happening in the same place over and over again, you would think, well, perhaps there's something else going on here. Something's triggering this. But it seems to like to take a little tour.
Yeah, it's so interesting how some of this stuff shows up. And oftentimes there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to it. But I think you brought up a really good point, which is, you know, is this proof? Is that proof? Is, you know, what I'm experiencing proof? And that becomes such a hard bar to measure, especially when we understand that our perception, everything that we're experiencing, is a result of our own frequencies and how we're thinking and the things that we experience, whether or not we're open to these things. You know, you could experience this thing and then have somebody who's a complete, you know, completely not expecting, you know, complete skeptic, you know, be in the same space and not experience it at all because they're just perceiving it within different frequencies with a different filter. And so everybody is really responsible for their own reality. And oftentimes people will say, well, you're saying it's in my head. No, not at all. It's absolutely something that's happening. You know, it's measurable and whatnot, but our own state of expectation and our own state of being and how we move through the world is so indicative of the types of experiences that we're going to have. So if somebody is saying, you know, well, you know, I don't believe in any of this stuff, nothing ever happens to me. Well, they're manifesting that and they're right. Nothing ever happens to them. They're completely 100% correct. And in their reality, in their world, it doesn't exist. But yet, you know, you can have somebody like us who is, you know, walking through the world and having these things happen. And it's, you know, this is absolutely a reality and it's something that's measurable and you can, you know, you can talk about just in the same way that the skeptics, if they're saying it doesn't happen, that's measurable too. So it's our world exists in, there are no absolutes in it. It's really fascinating.
I'm also delighted to see that you touch on something that I'm sort of having a second love affair within the world of the paranormal, which is EVPs.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by this. I've been listening to a lot recently from sort of the end of the 90s and the early noughties when people were still using tape recorders, for God's sake. Yeah, look them up, kids. And
I know, eh?
you'll never understand the frustration of not having a pencil to fix your tape. But it's another thing that I think has certainly seemed to sort of drop off the paranormal map these days, that sometimes people, occasionally you'll see them being, they'll use digital recorders or whatever these days. And often, especially if it's in regards to modern paranormal television, the vast majority of them are done on an entertainment basis more than an intellectually challenging or educational basis. So I'm very reticent about some of the modern examples, but when you look at some of these old ones, there are two conclusions you can draw from some of these older experiments in this particular field, Morgan, that they were either fakes or they were real. There's no middle ground here.
Yeah. And EVP has got such a long history, I think, that people negate. And there really is, in my personal opinion, I really believe that there's something to them. You know, over the years, I remember doing the tape recorder thing. And back in the day, you know, like I remember that. And I remember, and then switching over to the digital and things like that. But, you know, Steph and I learned some really cool lessons when we were doing EVP. And one of those lessons was our state of mind and our state of being as we were doing them and in relationship to the types of results that we were getting. And that's one of the reasons why I mentioned it in the Gift of Instinct was because it wasn't so much the fact that, you know, EVPs were proof of this or proof of that. But what we learned was that when we let go and we were just having fun and we were laughing amongst each other and just, you know, having a good time and just putting down the kind of stoic type of attitude that you often see on the TV shows where everybody's sitting around and they're grim and, you know, waiting for an answer and things like that. When we did that, we found we got absolutely nothing. It was radio silence. And yet when we were having fun and we were still following our own little book of protocol and whatnot, making sure everything was filmed and whatever, and we're doing these recordings, we would end up coming back with all of these really fun audio bits and pieces that were, some of them were really random, some of them were answers to questions, some of them were, you know, just voices or noises that we couldn't explain. At one point, we had the residual energy of a telephone ringing in a building that had no phones because it was so old, it had no power. And it was a telephone ringing over and over and over and over again. And so we had all these really neat things happen, but it was always when we were ourselves in joy and when we had just let go the expectation of what was going to happen and took our attention from it. So we would set an intention and then just start having fun. And that process brought us more results than at any point for us sitting around and trying to make it happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned it in regards to Ouija boards as well, that you've just got to lighten up. And there are often occasions, I mean, it's not something I've done for a very long time, but there are numerous occasions where I will put my hand on my heart and I will say that 95% of the Ouija board sessions I did were a load of old nonsense.
Yeah.
But there are a handful of things that happened and communications we got that were, I wouldn't necessarily say frightening or challenging, but for me, they were the kinds of conversations that would be hard pressed for someone just to pluck out of the air for some overeager teenager to create in their minds, Morgan. Yeah. There was one that always struck me. We were doing one particular session and everybody was having a laugh and talking nonsense and people were pretending that Satan had turned up and all that kind of stuff and wizards and witches and all things. And we ended up getting this communication from a young lad who drowned on a boating trip in Lake Windermere. Why he decided to come to Yorkshire after that, I don't know, but that's how it was. And we were talking to him and he seemed to be very keen on one of the young lads who was with us, who I'm still friends with to this day, who lives in Australia now. And he was chatting away to him, they were getting on like that. And he was saying, oh, how can I help you? He said, oh, well, basically it all came down to the fact that this entity or whatever it was wanted to come into my friend and he wanted him to then go and find his ex-girlfriend who had cheated on him at his funeral with his best friend. And he wanted him to murder them both.
Oh, my God.
And I was thinking, you know, this is like 30 years ago, Morgan, and it still stuck with me. It was a lovely summer's evening when we had this conversation. I remember it distinctly. And it's one of those things that you think, well, why have I remembered that for the best part of 30 years? Because it was so different to everything else that we went through, like I say, that it's one of those that I think I was either in the presence of a fabulous fiction author who never reached the heights of their perhaps talent that they've kept hidden for the rest of their lives as they plodded on normally as many people do, or it was something very, very odd.
Yeah. Well, and some of the best channeling sessions that because oftentimes people think, well, Ouija boards, you know, it's just evil and they have terrible experiences or frightening experiences like that one. And I think people write it off as something that's just negative and evil. And yet some of the best and most positive channeling sessions have come through things like that, like the very famous Esther Hicks.
Yeah.
That's how it started for her. And, you know, all of that has just been so joyful and so positive and whatever. But I think where people get lost in this, and this is often, I think, that the hang up that people have about things like Ouija boards and stuff like that, is that when people, the average Joe, especially kids, you know, when they sit down to, you know, communicate with something otherworldly, they've already got this, you know, anxiety or fear, or, you know, we're going to get something frightening, or, you know, they're in depression or grief because they've lost a loved one and they're trying to get a hold of that person. And what they don't realize is that where you are emotionally is a direct reflection of anything that you're going to get back. So even when I have people come to me and ask, okay, like, what do I do? You know, I'm so desperately missing this person. You know, how do I reach out to them? And the first thing I say to them is, not right now. Because what happens is that you end up getting these responses that are a reflection, not of, you're not going to get a hold of the loved one who's now in pure positive energy and is part of life's source now and part of the broader consciousness. You're going to, there's something else is there that you end up tapping into that's so ego driven, and it's, you know, very much of the mind, and it's not what you want to be talking with. So I think that state of expectation and that level of emotional, that emotional awareness. And when you sit down to actually, you know, use something like this, whether it be Ouija board or EVP or anything else, because it really is all the same. And, you know, being able to then turn around and go, okay, like where am I? You know, where am I in this? And when you can do that, then the responses, it can be absolutely amazing, really amazing.
Yeah, I think that is the thing. I think often, especially this day and age, they've got such a negative connotation around them that, as you say, I find it very hard pressed that anybody who wants to start doing something like Ouija is going to go into that clear of mind without thinking that if they're not careful, they're just going to get Beelzebub on the other end of the line coming through to possess them.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the belief of most people. You know, they think that there is just nothing but evil there. And, you know, they're just, things are just working and waiting to come and get you and whatnot, which, I mean, which is like why kids do Bloody Mary in a mirror, you know? and it's something that people have always loved. It's like the ghost story around the campfire type thing. And they, you know, they want that thrill, they want that scare and whatnot, which is so much fun. But yeah, if you go into that with that state of expectation, then that's usually what you're going to end up with. And you know, then they get what they ask for and they're like, oh, this thing was terrible, this item is bad. And it's like, well, no, you know, this anything that you're using is just a channel for the energy that you're using to connect with. So
yeah, and everybody knows that the only way to contact evil is to buy a rock album and play it backwards. Everybody knows.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, whether it be let's see, who can we nail to the cross over these poor bands. Like, I don't even, you know, I don't understand that. But yeah, it's really interesting what people get in their head as to, you know, what they think is gonna, I don't know, conjure,
yes,
conjure evil or I don't know. Poor Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, yeah. The Judas Priest case especially is a prime example of hysteria in action. And if anybody's not aware of it, I would always advise anybody to dive into the Judas Priest hidden messages call case that was happening, I think, in the mid-80s, because it's just remarkable, primarily because the proof just showed how silly it was, because I think one of the messages ended up being, do not sit on the wonky chair.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I mean, there's been, even over the years, there was a festival that was blamed for a bunch of satanic murders at one point. There was a person who attended this festival and came back and, like, he killed his friends and family. And there's been a number of cases like that where, you know, it's all been blamed and, oh, it's, you know, it's the music's fault or whatever. And it's like, no, this is about people being disconnected, yeah, with consciousness. That's all it is.
Absolutely. I think the recent series of Stranger Things as well, I know some people thought it was a bit far-fetched, the whole Dungeons and Dragons Satanic Panic storyline, but for anybody that lived through that decade, yeah, that was a real thing for some people. And it's remarkable how when these things happen, and obviously we had a satanic panic here in the UK, and there were these covens hiding everywhere, an extremely awful case about children being removed from families based on false testimony and bias, and it caused all kinds of problems. And it all turned out that none of it was true. It was all delusions from one particular person in one particular case, where nearly 50 children were removed from their homes because of this one child's story.
Yeah, and we, you know, we see that. We see that often. Again, it's just this sort of level of unconsciousness where people, instead of looking inwards, they start to, you know, they have to point to something that is outside of themselves, that, well, it's this thing that was, you know, that made them do it, or that thing made them do it, or, you know, we'll create something that's outside of us because it surely couldn't have been our fault for whatever reason. And it's interesting, you know, and then of course they drag their kids into it and stuff like that too. But, you know, it all comes back to the same thing, you know, which is, you know, part of this book, is the fact that level of unconscious living, it is just going to make you miserable, and it bleeds into everybody around you. And I think that's why, you know, following, being able to get in touch with that instinct and whatnot is so important, because if we don't, and we're not following that calling, and we're not, you know, on a path that's making us, you know, excited and joyful and happy, or something that we can at least have acceptance about, then it just causes suffering at the end of the day, whether it be yours or, you know, somebody else's, or usually both. And so, you know, you get these cases where people are just sort of, you know, trying to look outside themselves and trying to find, you know, well, it was the music, and the music's evil, or the Ouija board is evil. And it's like, no, there's, you know, there's something to be learned from this, but people have to be willing to ask bigger questions.
Absolutely. And evil has always been with us, even before these cultural trends appeared. So I find it once you, you know, you look at it in a mature and balanced manner, you realize just how silly it is often.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the people over the years, like even the spiritual teachers that have been, you know, told that they're evil or whatnot, or their content is evil. I mean, it's absolutely laughable. But again, and most of them, I find, are the ones who absolutely have never picked up any of the books or read them.
Yeah.
They've not attended anything. They've not actually read what's there. They have no idea. And that's some of the danger of beliefs when it comes to this kind of type of a thing too, like we were talking about before, where people tend to get a very rigid system of belief, is that belief system ends up stopping you from being able to connect inward and have these things happen. You know, if you've got a super rigid belief system and you're just shutting everything down that is not in alignment with that belief system, then you're closing yourself off to some of these experiences that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, as you dive into, obviously the biggest issue a lot of people have is fear, because that permeates all aspects of our life, regardless. And I think often for some people, once you finally break free of that shackle of, I don't care what people think anymore, I'm very happy following the interests I follow, this makes me a better person, I think for many people, there is this fear of standing out or being different. And it's sort of entrenched into people in school, I think, that everybody needs to fit in. You have to have the right clothes, the right hair, the right attitude, like the right things, like the right bands, fancy the right people, whoever they may be. And it continues into adult life. And people, I think, are often so programmed, Morgan, by this whole cultural blindness, that anybody that goes outside of their preconceived parameters or their ideas of what is fitting in is weird, odd, strange. And once you realize, you get to a certain age, it took me quite a while, but once I got to that certain age, I just jumped out of that lane and just went, I don't care anymore. And I've never been happier, if I have to be honest.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I mean, it's that moment where you realize that, you know, even when you're in that situation, that nothing that you're reaching for outside of you is going to make you happy. That's not where happiness, true happiness, comes from. And I had to learn that at a very early age, because I was severely bullied in school, like really, really badly. I had a horrific school experience. But I learned that very early on, because I had tried that. I had tried to be friends with those people. I tried to, you know, wear the right clothes. I tried to do these things. And no matter what I did, it was, I was still the outcast. I was still made fun of. I was still, there was always something, because the problem wasn't the clothing. The problem was their unconsciousness. And I had to realize that really early on. And I ended up doing exactly what you did, where I completely went in the opposite direction, because I figured these people are going to hate me no matter what I do.
Yes.
So I may as well be happy doing what I want to do.
Yes.
And they can hate me as I'm doing it. And thank God that I ended up with that attitude, because it's carried me throughout life. You know, I've always been a big risk taker. I take risks in my job, my career all the time. And I don't have any fear of that. I don't have fear of public ridicule. You know, I don't read people's comments for the most part. You know, if I put something out there and, you know, people criticize it, it really is water off a duck's back to me, because it's really their opinion is just literally none of my business. And so I really take that side of it to heart, because as soon as you're roping your happiness in with somebody else and somebody else's opinion, you automatically have lost a big, big game. And you're never, ever going to be able to please somebody 100% of the time, all the time. It just isn't going to happen. So you have to be able to look internally and find that joy first. And then all of these joyful experiences start to manifest in your experience. You know, people often think, well, if I just get this thing, if I just reach out there and I get this thing, then I'm going to be happy. Well, no, you're going to be happy. And then that thing is going to come to you, and you don't have to do the reaching. But the primary step, no matter what it is alignment with yourself and the present moment and acceptance. And as soon as you got that, and you've got that fundamental happiness, then everything else starts to open the doors up.
I think a prime example, one of the last characters I want to touch on, Morgan, is the marvelous Dr. Eben Alexander, who is one of those people that, as we've mentioned earlier, here we have a man set in his field with the respect and kudos that a man of his position and stature could carry. And he ends up having an experience that not only changes his life, but the lives of everybody involved with him, especially in how they view him and what he's saying to them after what's happened to him. So for anybody who's unaware of this remarkable story, could you tell us exactly what happened to Mr. Alexander?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. This is, to me, this was one of the most powerful stories that I had researched and read about. I've heard him lecture on various videos, and I had to include him. And so Dr. Eben Alexander is a neurologist, and he was one of the best in his field, is one of the best in his field. And he ended up with a very rare case of meningitis, and it put him into a coma. And he was extremely ill. The medications that they were giving him just weren't working. And finally, the doctors came to the family and said, look, you know, this is the end of the line. Like, it's, we don't know what's going on, but nothing's working. And his son, upon hearing that, ran into his dad's hospital room and was like, you need to wake up right now, like right now. And he did. And he opened his eyes and he looked at his family. And the first thing he said was, all is well. And they couldn't figure it out. They were like, what just happened? And as he came around and was started to be able to communicate again and whatnot, he ended up explaining to the family and his caregivers that he had this profound experience when he was in a coma, and that his consciousness had gone elsewhere, had gone to this incredible place. And he'd experienced this plethora of amazing things. And one of the most unique things that he had touched on was something called the girl on the butterfly wing. And he said there was this, he encountered these entities, which were these bright, bright lights. And he was one of those as well. But he felt that these entities were something that were far older, far more aware than even he was. And he saw this app, almost like apparition of this girl that was floating on this beautiful palette of shimmering colors. And the best way he could describe it, he said it was like a butterfly wing. It was like this moving butterfly wing. And he didn't recognize her. He had no idea who she was, but he had this deep connection with her. And when he after he had this amazing experience and he came back and he didn't want to, he had even said, I would rather have stayed in this non-physical place. He said it was pure love, pure joy, just absolute bliss. But he said the awareness and the consciousness that was around me had said, don't ever forget this place. Don't ever forget this vibration, but you got to go back. So he comes back into, you know, wakes up, of course, his son wakes him up, and he starts to report his experience. And at first he was in complete belief about this experience and what had happened. And then people started to come to him and say, well, you know, did you see your father who had passed away recently? And he said, well, no. Well, did you see these people and your grandparents? And did you see? And he said, well, no, I didn't see anybody, actually. I just saw this girl. Well, who was the girl? Well, I don't know. And so he started to gather some doubt, and he thought, oh my God, like, you know, what if this was just in my head? This was a chemical reaction. Like, what is going on? And it wasn't until he was actually going through some photographs, and it was some old photographs. I think it was with his mom, and she passed him a picture of a girl who had passed away, and it turned out it was his sister who he had not met. Mm. And lo and behold, the girl in the butterfly wing was his sister, and he'd never seen her. And at that point, he knew 100%. He was like, everything I experienced, that was real. And he took the world of neuroscience by storm, because nobody at that point, you know, had, I mean, there were people who were taking it seriously, but very few had come out and had something like this happen. And it was just absolutely profound. But his message was, I think, the most important part of the whole thing, which is, this energy, this consciousness is loving. It is there for us. It is accessible to us, and is something that everybody is a piece of. And that's why I include it in the book, because it is an absolute profound lesson in exactly what we're talking about right now.
Absolutely. It's very affirming. I think often when people discuss these kinds of concepts, there is this, once again, this unconscious bias that for some, it must be punishment, or you will meet specific people in your life. You have to. Once again, there are these rules of what's supposed to happen to you if you have a near-death experience. You are supposed to see this person and that person and have this memory and have this experience. And when you look at this, clearly there was something there. And it's almost as if you could say, well, she was waiting for him to show him what was there, and that she was fine. It was all fine. Yes, she'd moved on, but she was fine. And This is here for him when he wants it. But as you say, they basically just said, but unfortunately, this is not your time. So you have to go back and deal with normal life for a bit, and we'll see you when you get here.
Yeah. And they've all, or the majority of them, have had that very, very similar message where, you know, they've been told, don't forget this. You're not meant to forget this. You're supposed to hold on to this and come back to this feeling whenever you're in doubt or anything like that. This is real. And, you know, this is consciousness at its finest, at its purest form. And it's something we all have access to, you know, when we're able to quiet the mind and be with acceptance in the present moment. And, These stories are unforgettable when you read them, and if you really can take them to heart and start working with them for yourself, these realities they come forward in such innumerable and amazing ways. They're just life changing.
And I suppose regardless of anybody's background, Morgan, when you have an experience like that and you come back, I think if anybody has ever had an experience where they've had a very close brush with death, or they've been involved in a traumatic incident, or lived through trauma in their life, often it's very difficult to get through that and look back on the life that's happened before that particular incident. In the same way, it completely changes your whole perceptions of yourself and your position in the world and what reality really means.
Yeah. And I think people can go two ways about it. I think some people, you know, take it and they go completely into ego, and they just go to, you know, poor me, I can't believe this happened to me. You know, and they go completely in the other direction. And then you've got the people that use it as that, like what we're talking about, that moment of awakening, where they're like, not only did I survive this, but there's a meaning to the suffering that just occurred. And they begin to realize that they can use their life and use their platform for something so much greater. And Evan Alexander is such a perfect example of that, where he realized, he's like, you know, I've had this experience. I could keep this to myself. You know, I could keep the wolves from the door in terms of, you know, colleagues that might criticize me and whatever. And I mean, it would have been the easier thing for him to do ultimately career-wise, but he didn't. He realized, he knew that there was something in this that was needed within the material world here.
Yeah.
And offered that. And I think it's, you know, I think that energy has been behind him the whole way, because I mean, his book's been so successful and people are listening with open ears.
Very true. And I think for many people, it's something that they need to hear, because I think when we often talk about these subjects, as we've said, I mean, the wonderful thing about the book is it's a collection of lessons that you've brought together. But these are, once again, Morgan, these are not rules, but these are focal points that everybody can appreciate, that everybody can understand, that everybody has some experience in, that often, once we realize that there are no rules, that for some, to be happy, to find true happiness, you have to rip up this imaginary rule book that often many of us are forced to follow for a long periods of our life. And then, and only then, do we realize what our true potentials is in whatever field it may be.
Absolutely. And that's the thing with this subject matter, is that it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, there are so many ways that we can't even begin to fathom of how things can come together to work in our benefit and to go down that path to find that presence and that consciousness and that alignment within ourselves. There's so many different areas, and it's not all smushed together in one religion, or it's not all smushed together in a written rule book, like this is how it's going to look and this is how your life's going to look because your grandfather's life was that way and your father's life was that way and so on and so forth. And, you know, we've got to really be able to let that go and realize that our life is here for us to design, and that life itself is something that we are. It is not something we can lose, because we are life. And when we really understand that, we realize that this consciousness is accessible and has the answers and will hear us and come with us and guide us in these different ways. It really does become something where, even if somebody is throwing the rule book at you, you know, it starts to bounce off. You're not looking at it in the same way as you would have been maybe if, you know, well, I've got to do what, you know, my family did, or I have to, you know, I got to keep quiet about this because, you know, that might be an embarrassment to these people, or so on and so forth. And when you stop living it so conditionally, and you stop living from that space of conditional thinking, then so many of these things begin to just appear in your life or become present in your life in ways that you can't even imagine until you really start the work. So, and that was the goal with the book, and especially in the last chapter when we get into people like Neville Goddard and Napoleon Hill and people like that who were working this information, who J.B. Ryan was Napoleon Hill was a student of J.B. Ryan, and all of these people that have taken this information and go, okay, how do we make this practical for people that they can understand it so that they can do this too? It doesn't have to be all stuck up in a lab. We can all take part in this and figure this out.
Absolutely. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I have to say, it's one of those books that after reading it, it made me feel all warm and smiley, Morgan.
Oh,
and
because thank
it,
you.
Because it brought a lot home to me as well. I have to say, it touched me in a couple of chapters in regards to how my life has been and certain aspects of it, and how I've pushed through in certain situations, or found myself in situations like that where I was just so deeply unhappy with my life. And it was only, as I said flippantly earlier, Poltergeist saved my life. And it was a book when I was recovering from being seriously mentally ill, that is a particular story about a poltergeist that I'd never heard of. And that was the spark.
That's amazing. And this stuff, that's the magic and the power behind the subject matters we're talking about. It's so special.
Morgan, where can everybody get a copy of this wonderful book? and follow your work and listen to your marvelous podcast as well?
We can find The Gift of Instinct, Paranormal Lessons for an Extraordinary World on Amazon. And you can find it also on entityseeker.ca. So that's entityseeker, not plural, .ca. And you can grab your copy there, as well as my other book, Teaching the Living. And you'll see it because there's my wonderful Galen, my python, is on the cover, because pythons are representative of rejuvenation and healing, mm-hmm. and absolute presence. So that's why he's on the cover.
Fabulous. As always, it's an absolute pleasure. I could speak to you for hours, but however, I know you've got things to do, and so have I. It's one of those conversations, whenever I speak to you, Morgan, it's like I've only just spoken to you last time, and it's usually about a year. So thank you as always for fitting me in. It's always lovely to spend some time in your company. I wish you the best of luck with the book and your forthcoming endeavors, and hopefully, and I probably know so, we will speak again in the future.
Oh, we sure will. Thank you so much for all of this and your amazing words. And I appreciate you. And I'm so grateful that you enjoyed the book. And thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Take care.